From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, Possessed Children with David Weatherly. Wow, does it get any scarier? Here's what's happening. An intense search continues in the Mediterranean Sea off of Greece now for the apparent wreckage of an Egyptian air flight that went down earlier in the day, as we reported last night on the program, with 66 people on board. No explosion was detected by infrared satellites in the vicinity of the crash area. Officials from Egypt Air initially said debris from the plane was found off a Greek island. That was not the case. And of course, remember MH370 from a couple years ago, the Malaysian plane. That has disappeared as well. Noted Peter Luntz, our dear friend and author of Cover Up, What the Government is Still Hiding About the War on Terror, is with us. Peter, I want your observations on this crash first before we get into some other issues here. What do you think?
Well, unfortunately, there hasn't been any claim of, I shouldn't say unfortunately, because it would be good. It was good for the world if it wasn't an act of terror.
Yeah.
But typically ISIS, within hours of a crash, as they did in Sharm el-Sheikh in October of 2015, they claimed credit immediately. There hasn't been any claim of credit, and although it is likely that it's an act of terrorism, and a bomb is the most likely scenario, notwithstanding the lack of an explosive presence so far, detection devices. But this goes back, as I've said many times, you and I have talked about this on the program many times, as early as 1994, Ramzi Youssef planted an improvised explosive device aboard a Philippine Airlines flight, almost crashed it, and I've written extensively about my belief that TWA-800 was the result, the crash was the result of a bomb, mm-hmm. an Al-Qaeda bomb. So if ISIS didn't take credit, there's still some life left in Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. They're the most likely suspects to pull off an attack like this, if it could be another group other than ISIS. So the jury's still out.
Peter, do you think that, if there was a bomb, and apparently it feels like there might have been, it was a suicide bomber on the plane, or was this something that made its way into the cargo bay?
It's a great question. The cargo bay scenario was Pan Am 103. Suicide scenario, well, first of all, you have to go back and look at the fact that there was actually an Egypt Air crash in which one of the pilots intentionally crashed the plane a number of years ago.
That's right.
In New England. So that scenario is a possibility. But the device that was used that ISIS claimed was really just a soda can device, really tiny. The device that Youssef created was one in which he basically took a Casio data bank watch, a diluted nitroglycerin in a contact lens cleaning bottle, hooked it into a circuit, set the bomb in the life jacket pouch below the what he thought was the center wing fuel tank of the plane, got off the plane after the first leg, and as the plane headed to Narita in Japan, the bomb blew, killed a young Japanese man in the seat, blew a hole through the fuselage, and almost crashed the plane. So it doesn't take much, George, in the way of a tiny IED to bring down a major airliner.
Peter, isn't this unusual that we've now had, within a couple of years, two major planes that have just simply vanished, and they really can't find debris of either one of them?
It's astonishing. I mean, frankly, a number of people who listen to your program and where you report news that just you can't find anywhere else, it's the kind of eerie phenomena that, again, you just, how could this happen? How could something, an entity that large, just vanish twice?
I know.
But anyway, in this case, I'm putting my money, if you will, on an act of terror, and I believe it will be an explosive device, but we'll have to see.
I think you're right. Peter Lance's website, peterlance.com. Peter, keep in touch with us. Got to have you back for at least a couple more hours. A global revolution in the use of antimicrobials is needed, according to a government-backed report. Jim O'Neill, who led the review on antimicrobial resistance, said a campaign was needed to stop people treating antibiotics like their cookies and sweets. He said in the recommendation that the global plan for preventing medicine being cast back into the dark ages if we keep doing this. Superbugs resistant to antibiotics are estimated to account for 700,000 deaths each year on the planet. Scientists are thinking now that they see evidence of two huge tsunamis having once swept across the surface of Mars. They point to satellite data suggesting a major redistribution of sediments over a large region at the edge of the red planet's northern lowlands. That's a great story there. Sports Authority plans to close its remaining stores after liquidators made a successful bid to acquire the chain's assets in a bankruptcy auction. The Inglewood, Colorado-based sporting goods retailer filed for bankruptcy earlier this year and closed about 140 stores. At one point, they had 450 stores company-wide. Sports Authority, say goodbye. Donald Trump holding a slight lead over Hillary Clinton, 45% to 42%, among registered voters, according to a new national Fox News poll. Let's check in with Howard Bloom and get his reaction to this one. Howard, what do you think of this?
Well, it depends. It depends on which poll you're looking at. The Rasmussen poll has Donald Trump ahead by 5 points. The New York Times poll has Hillary Clinton ahead by 6 points. But the real deal is this. Donald Trump has done three things in the last 48 hours that give some real sharp insights into his leadership style. He's proposed 11 Supreme Court nominees. He's accused Bill Clinton of rape, and he's let it be known that he's taken in a man that you've never heard of, the former head of the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency, a guy named General Michael Flynn, as one of his advisors. And that last move, Michael Flynn, may be the most important of the three. So what do these three moves mean? Trump's 11 Supreme Court nominees show that he's capable of winning over opponents. He's capable of compromise. The list looks like it was drawn up by Paul Ryan or Mitch McConnell. It calms a fear. Traditional Republicans were afraid that the Supreme Court nominations that Donald Trump would make would not contribute to the conservative crusade, and the result would be, they want judges who will outlaw abortion and make guns legal for adults, even adults who are visiting kindergartens. And Trump's 11 judges are pro-gun, and they're anti-abortion. So with step one, Trump proves that he can bring Republican factions together. Now, Trump's second move was to accuse Bill Clinton of rape. This is a typical Trump, the ringmaster, maneuver. No media outlet in the world can resist a story that combines a big name and sex. So whether the accusation is true or not, every journalist and editor is forced to run it. So that smears the Clintons and it elevates Trump. But Trump move number three is the big one. It's the one that hints that the Donald may be good at hiring smart people. One of the people Trump has brought in to advise him is General Michael Flynn. And who is General Michael Flynn? He was head of the Defense Intelligence Agency under guess who? Barack Obama.
Uh-huh.
Now the deal is that Flynn apparently understood that most of us in the West do not understand militant Islam. We don't know where jihad comes from, what motivates it, and what jihadists want to achieve. What's worse, Flynn was under orders to produce essentially phony intelligence reports, reports that backed the story the White House favors, that Islam is a religion of peace and that Islam only makes war because of legitimate grievances. Flynn was beginning to understand that this interpretation of militant Islam is false. Militant Islam makes war. It makes jihad to conquer the world, to take the world on behalf of the only true religion. And that form of war is an absolute command from the one true prophet, Muhammad himself. But Flynn was under orders to deliberately misunderstand jihad. So he quit about a year ago. And Trump has apparently taken him in. Now, that's a smart move, and it's a move that fits one of the truest things that Donald Trump has said. He said, something is going on with Islamic terrorism, and we don't understand what it is. We shouldn't go any further in accepting 20,000 Muslim refugees until we understand, which means Trump has shown three faces this week. The face of the party unifier with his 11 Supreme Court nominations, the face of reality TV at its worst with his claims that Bill Clinton is a rapist, and the face of a possible president with his association with General Michael Flynn.
Well, he's doing something, and he's on all cylinders right now. Howard, thank you. 60 Minutes correspondent Morley Safer, who retired just a week ago after 52 years at CBS, has died. He was 84 years old. 60 Minutes had said goodbye to Safer on Sunday, honoring the newsman who was a fixture at the CBS News magazine. The tribute marked the close of a decades-long career for Safer, who, according to the program, had the longest ever run on primetime television. I was able to obtain his very first report when he reported on the 9th International Congress on Rheumatic Diseases when he was in Canada. Take a listen.
The losses caused by rheumatic diseases are greater than the losses suffered during all the wars ever fought by man. This is an international problem that must bypass all political boundaries. This is Morley Safer returning you to Gordon Burwash.
That was in 1957. Now, tomorrow night, our guest is going to be former CBS newsman Dan Rather. We're going to talk about Dan's life, but we'll get his reaction to Morley Safer's death as well. A study into the working patterns and downtime of 2,000 people found that 7 in 10 people feel overworked with work stress and too few proper breaks, the leading causes of a lack of me time. How about that? In a moment, we're going to talk about some predictions and trends with George Uhrer next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George, you're back with us. He publishes his UrbanSurvival.com website all the time, and his PeopleNomics.com website lays out very highly unusual perspectives of the economy based on long-term cycles. He's a predictor, he's a trends expert, and he's back on Coast to Coast. George, great time to have you back.
Well, thank you, George. It's great to be back, and I guess this is something of a victory lap.
It is for you.
Yeah, I was on in January, and there were a lot of people that you had on as guests making their first of the year predictions.
That's right.
What they saw ahead. And I predicted at that point that the market would bottom out in February, and that by May, we could be moving toward new all-time highs. We, at this point, we're still in that first part of May. There's an old Wall Street saying, sell in May and go away.
How appropriate.
We've been doing that, but I don't think, you know, myself, that we're going to see much more of it. My wife and I, in our account, will probably go back on the long side of the market when we get past the current little stumbling block, which could take us down maybe to 2020 or even 2000 on the S&P. But there are several reasons to be extremely optimistic, at least through the election. One of the reasons...
And we're going to talk about that, too. I want to get your take on what's going on there. Jeez.
Yeah, that's one heck of an election coming up. The big thing I think that's going to be pushing us is the Federal Reserve. If you look at... there were a lot of people worried about the Fed minutes when they came out today. But the real item going on in background is the Federal Reserve has what's called the H6 Money Report, and you can find it online.
What's that?
Well, that basically is the Fed's tally of how much cash and equivalents, better known as M1, and how much M2, which is cash, equivalents, and some term deposits. And they update this every week or so. And the important thing is, if you look at what the most recent 90-day period is, they're pushing up M1 in circulation at 11.6% annualized. Well, when the Fed is being that loose with the money and really goosing things, some of that money is bound, I think, to show up in the stock market. So while there are going to be some folks here in the next few days who are going to worry about, you know, gosh, the ECB has a meeting coming up on June 2nd, and our Fed meets, I think it's June
6th. Well, they're talking about an interest rate bump.
They have been. And you know what's really funny about this, and I've gone back and forth with a few friends who are bond traders, they don't see it. But here's the mechanics of what I think will happen. Holding bonds was a great thing from 1987 when bonds were up around 14-15% until now, because bonds have come down to the lowest point in anyone's recent memory. I mean, this is so far below where interest rates were in the Great Depression.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it's crazy. And so what ends up happening is money is always looking for the best possible return. So it doesn't take very much in the way of a bump in the stock market and rates reversing in bonds. Remember, as rates go up, the value of a bond goes down. And so what will happen, I think, will be when the Fed actually begins to move the rates again, just like happened in April of 1928, we'll begin to see the formation of that final blow-off peak in the market. And that should take us through the election and then maybe first quarter of 2017. But that's where it gets to be exciting. I mean, I can hardly wait for next year. I know, don't rush, it'll get here, right?
It's faster than you think.
By then I will have read your book that comes out in July. The thing that'll happen is we have seen a real problem for presidents in their first term. In other words, George Bush, 2001, took office. And it was that was January, and then
look what happened in September.
Yeah, September. So he got 8 months. Barack Obama took office in 2009, and the market was bottoming in April, so he inherited a real mess too. And it's pretty likely, because there's a 7 to 8 year cycle that somewhat corresponds to the presidency. There are some fixed investment cycles and so forth. And when these things gang up, really the news follows the cycle, and people get confused over, you know, which horse is pulling. But I think we're going to have a really good rest of this year. Next year, probably around inauguration time, I'm tentatively looking to go short, but a lot of things can change. The thing that's really unknown is how much watering down the Fed will do of the purchasing power of the dollar.
Okay, I want to talk about the presidential campaign and get your take on that,
sure.
George. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that Hillary Clinton, even if she loses the primaries, will pick up enough delegates from those primaries. She's not that far away from getting the nomination. What do you think there?
I think you're right, but the wild card is FBI Director Comey. He's got, I've heard numbers as high as 130 agents working on the Clinton email case, and it's one which is going extremely slowly. Some informed speculation might go to the idea that what if there was more than just State Department emails on that server? What if there were perhaps foundation transactions or emails on the
screen? And our dear friend Jerome Corsi's coming out with a book soon about that foundation. So
yeah,
who knows?
And why is that foundation rolling in so much money? So we have to sit back really before we write Hillary Clinton off to see if the FBI comes up with anything chargeable. And I wrote recently that Comey, you've got to give him as much slack as possible, because it's one thing to file charges against somebody running for office, but it's quite another when you begin to ask, which he may be asking questions about a former president. And so you've really got to dot the I's, cross the T's, take your time and get it all right, because there's only going to be one shot at this. And whether or not then the Justice Department acts on it, that's where we'll get to what could be a breakpoint in the administration. If charges are not filed, will Comey remain in office, or would he step down because maybe he thinks there are grounds? You know, it's really a mess, George.
How about the Republicans now? They seem to have calmed down a little bit and accept Donald Trump. What do you think?
Well, personally, I like Trump. I think Trump is saying the right things. He's talking to the working class people. There are people that have worked for him who are coming out and saying, you know, guy's a great guy. The only problems that I see with Trump are going to be pretty much the campaign issues that'll be thrown at him about women and TV and reality shows and all that kind of stuff. You know, the typical political blah, blah. Right now, if I were guessing, I'd kind of have to go with the Rasmussen poll where he's 5 up and say that his strategy, especially bringing General Flint on, that will probably play very well to what would have been the Nixonian or Reagan silent majority. I think it could be a Trump landslide, but we'll wait and see.
Well, one of the things that got Kennedy elected back in 1960 was his stand on Cuba. He was informed about the Bay of Pigs invasion and talked about getting tough with Cuba. Nixon could not say anything because it was supposed to be confidential. Let's talk a little bit more about that, George, and more when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George, you're with us. His website, urbansurvival.com, and also peoplenomics.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. George, Kennedy got elected because of his Get Tough with Cuba stand, which Nixon couldn't say anything about because he knew about the Bay of Pigs, and he, because he was still part of the administration of Eisenhower, had to keep it quiet while Kennedy knew about it and was using it. It was an amazing campaign tactic.
Yeah, I think there's something of a rhyme historically going on with the way Trump is talking up the wall with Mexico. The real problem in foreign affairs and the disconnect between whatever the next administration is and the present one is that, very similarly to Europe, the U.S. seems to have bitten off on the idea of synthetic growth. And synthetic growth simply means when everybody has two cars, three televisions, eight phones, a tablet, and all the rest of consumer stuff that we've got, the easiest way to grow the economy may not be superior engineering and new products. Instead, it may be easier to bring in people with nothing and kit them up, sell them education, get them a place to live, bring cars to them, government programs, aid assistance, social work, ESL teachers, whatever it takes. And that's, I think, really where we are at the moment. I know that's what's been going on in Germany, and it's becoming problematic for Germany as well as the rest of the EU. It's also a major part of the whole Brexit thing, which comes up for a vote this summer, and which even President Obama has injected himself into British politics by saying, no, you should stay in the European Union. That's the kind of thing that will really weigh come election time. We've got the Obama administration. I just mentioned the Fed is really getting loose with the money, may raise rates a notch. And when they do that, that should create a huge bubble in the stock market. And if you have people coming in, lots of immigration, that tends to create artificial growth. At the end of the day, it'll be very difficult for Donald Trump to look at a record stock market and a lot of growth, regardless of where it comes from or the social price down the road. It'll be very hard for him to argue when the Democratic candidate comes out, whoever he or she is, Bernie or Clinton, are the only two really on the table. When they come out and say, look at our track record, we have the highest stock market in history, that's going to be a very hard sell because that's a right now number.
You've been writing about the possibility of another depression for a number of years. Where do we stand with that?
Yeah, we could have tipped into the second depression in 2001, 2002. We were ready.
It was bad.
It was bad. I mean, we had the tech wreck. And I know people who study the stock market go, well, you know, it wasn't that bad for the Dow, that bad for the S&P. But what they gloss over the $5 to $7 trillion of net savings that was lost in the tech wreck. And that's where the NASDAQ basically imploded. The stock prices were in free fall for months, and it got really ugly. Finally, the way to see through the haze of that occurred to me, gosh, in 2001, when I started adding up the value of the Dow, the S&P, and the NASDAQ, and then track that as what I call my aggregate index, because it's real easy to manipulate the Dow up or down 100 points in a week. It's real easy for optimism to sink into the old line industrial companies, you know, the Fortune 500 kind of firms. But when it gets into technology and invention, that's really the stuff that where our future comes from. And so I've been looking at the market this way for years now. What happened with 9/11 was we were saved by the overnight industry that 9/11 created. I know it sounds conspiratorial, but when you look at the reality of it, right after 9/11, we had the Patriot Act. Where did that come from so quickly? We had TSA, and we still have problems with TSA. You've seen the lines.
Oh, the lines are horrible.
Oh, they are. I mean, believe me, I'm glad I own my own airplane. The problem.
Lucky you.
Well, yeah. The thing that you have to realize is that we're a country that monetizes away every problem we have. We have a problem with prison populations. Great, let's monetize prisons. And we've done that. We have a problem with terrorism. Great, let's monetize that. We'll fight a war in Iraq, even if we get suckered into it, because it'll reduce the unemployment rate that was going to go up because of the tech wreck. Let's also, at the same time, hire lots of TSA. We'll reorganize DHS. All of those things happened. And so the security state saved, and it's paradoxical, but it really saved us from slipping into an economic depression in 2001, 2003. And again, what saved us in 2009 were the bailouts. Everybody hated the bailouts and said, why is the government giving away our money, da-da-da-da-da-da. But at the end of the day, look what happened. We managed to kick off a major upward move in the stock market that has really continued uninterrupted with normal corrections. There was a minor correction in 2011. We're in a minor correction now. But it looks to me like this thing should continue to zoom up through 2017. Now, when we get up to the top of 2017, then we sort of hit the brick wall. We hit the brick wall because by then, the bitter cost of immigration will begin to bite. By then, robotics will be coming in. By then, pension funds that were predicated on being able to grow their nest eggs by 6%, 7%, 8% are going to discover that they don't have money to pay retirement promises when we've been in a 2%, 3% world for as long as we have been. And at that point, with the interest rates beginning to edge up, we'll see that the interest on the federal debt, which is depends if you want to do on books, off books, but it's at least $19 trillion and considerably more if you include some of the off-book accounting. So those things begin to smack us. And at the same time, we have sort of run the gamut. How small can a phone get and still be useful? How many pixels before, you know, retina displays are as good as your eyes are ever going to get? And so we begin to run into the technical problem of what is progress at that point.
George, you have somehow added an ingredient to all this, and that is your dreams.
Yeah, that's a weird one.
What is this?
Well, I have had several dreams over the past, oh gosh, 5 years or so, that occasionally they will come true. I had a dream when my wife and I were vacationing in Arizona, and it was about a fatal car accident, a road closure, and a detour. And sure enough, I woke up and told her about it, and that was that. And as we were driving home from Arizona, all those pieces fell into place. Another dream I had was 18 hours. I posted a thing on my website about a weird dream involving an oil platform, a fire, and two murders. And 18 hours later, the Offshore Horizon spill in the Gulf happened. These things happened to me for no particular reason, except that we live out in the woods. We're out of the social umbrella. We don't watch much TV. Our diet is very little processed foods, you know, meat and vegetable kind of people. And we're out from a lot of the electronic noise that is in big cities. and we really sleep well. I mean, it's, you know, clean air in the country kind of thing. Whether that helps dream more clearly is debatable, and I don't claim all dreams are precognitive. As you may remember, back in 2008, I started a project which was called the National Dream Center, which was designed to catalog some of these things, because I'd had the offshore horizon dream at that point and was like, wow, that was really something. And they've continued, but, you know, the dreams are sometimes not very important stories. I had one a while back about a bus accident in Melbourne, Australia. And
you literally dreamed about a bus accident in Australia?
Yeah. And
that's weird.
Totally weird, right? But it was intense enough so that I could draw a map on my website of, you know, here's what it looked like. And about 4 hours later, here comes a story across the wire about a double-decker bus hitting an overpass, a bridge, in Australia. And the weird thing I found, this really sounds nuts, but you'll find it interesting, maybe.
Why, because I'm nuts?
I didn't say that.
You implied it.
We're all nuts in this world. The interesting thing to me was, in most of my dreams, the directions are in the dreams are about 90 degrees out from what they are in real life. I had a dream about being on a train that stopped in the middle of the night in Germany a while back, and I didn't think anything about it. The in the dream, the train was going north, but in real life, there was a head-on train collision in rural Germany, and I didn't even connect the dream with the train incident, because in the dream, what had happened, my wife and I in the dream were on the train, and we got off in the middle of the night, were lost, and ended up following a light, and you know that phrase is familiar with people who have different end-of-life experiences about going to the light and so forth. And in the dream, we went to the light, and there was construction of the station and lots of heavy equipment. So that was the dream. 3 days later, 4 days later, I'm scanning through headlines, and there's the heavy equipment of the dream. It's being used to pick up the mess from the train. And so, you know, you sit back and you go, wow, is that strange or what? As it turns out, even more recently, I had one I mentioned on the subscriber side last Saturday morning. I had a dream about being with my daughter on a big cliff someplace in California on a big green field that was overlooking a cliff. And my daughter in the dream went over to the edge of the cliff, and the ground started to shake a little bit, and this other presence in the dream said, don't worry, it's going to be a 3-0. So I didn't think anything about that, but then about an hour and a half later, here comes a USGS update, and there was a 2.8 earthquake in Greenfield, California, out on the coast. Now, it's weird how this stuff happens, but I'm eventually getting to a point. And the point is, oftentimes in dreams, it seems that the background, the playing field of the dream, if you will, comes through as useful information, even though the specific activities of the dreamer and other people in the dream may not make a lot of sense. The other thing that may be interesting to note is, when you are sleeping, is your head north, east, west, south? It seems that when I went back and made a log of all the directions my head was pointed when I was sleeping.
Sounds like feng shui, doesn't it?
It's closely related, and that's another area I've been getting into lately. we could talk about that. But just to finish up on the dream, when you dream and sleep, some people are north-south dream sleepers, others are east-west. And if you are sleeping the majority of your life east-west, and then you sleep north-south, there seems to be, at least with me and a few other people I've talked to about this, a tendency for the cartography, the dream world, to be out of kilter when it comes to directions. It's just an interesting note in passing about how dreams may or may not work.
Now, do you use this in your predictions?
Not really. I mean, it's interesting stuff. It's really fascinating, but...
There's a science behind it, I think.
Yeah, there's a science behind it, but it's a weird science because I think you've talked to Chris McCleary, right?
Yeah.
And the problem is that it's very difficult to sort out the, he calls it day residue, the stuff that pounds us every day through all the media. People have interesting dreams all the time, but a lot of it is triggered by a conversation or a new visual you noticed on the way to work or a television commercial or a movie ad, that kind of thing. But it's sometimes the background, the playing field that stuff is projected on that is conveying some information. I really encourage people to visit Chris's, National Dream Center and read some of the dreams and do some searches on keywords, like tsunami, earthquake, asteroid, all those kinds of things. But what seems to happen is like you had a thing on in your news blurb about tsunami on Mars.
Yeah,
we've had
that's
a lot
an amazing story.
Yeah, it really is. And it really goes almost off to the Velikovsky, collision of the worlds kind of stuff. But in the meantime, there have been a lot of predictors who've been using the term tsunami and subsidence and disappearing oceans or, that kind of verbiage. But it turns out that just having a big story like tsunamis on Mars may be what they were picking up on. And that's the funny part about language. You can never be sure whether, when you're looking at a prediction, whether it is telling you about a headline or whether it's telling you about a real event. Because obviously if a predictor is out there making predictions about tsunami this, tsunami that, and oceans and runouts and blah, 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 if it happened on Mars and it was a headline, the word is still valid. The archetypical part of tsunami is still there. It just happened to be on the wrong planet, and we're not all going to die tomorrow from it.
So let's take a look at this year. What do you see?
I think what we will see is going to surprise people to the upside.
To the upside.
Yeah, the upside. I think housing will continue to make recovery. The stock market may go on to new all-time highs.
So you don't see a collapse this year?
No, not this year. Not next year, different thing. But for this year, there's so much optimism. I mean, I talk to people.
Well, what killed, for example, Sports Authority? They're shutting down 450 stores, all gone. What killed them? Was it online?
Probably. The online world, there are two realities that have come from the Internet that we really underweight, George. One of them is the power of online retailers. We probably have UPS making two deliveries a week to us of Amazon stuff.
Sure.
Simply because pretty much anything I need.
Online has saved UPS.
Well, and the U.S. Post Office, which is also doing a lot of business.
Kept them alive, that's sure.
Exactly. The other industry that is having a tremendous effect is social media.
Let's talk about that when we come back, because that you're right. You're absolutely right. We're going to come back and take phone calls as well with George Ure, who's in the middle of predictions and trends. We'll be back.